You are listening to a sermon by John Clausen, recorded on Sunday, April 25th, 2010, at the Point Grey Intermennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
I'm very happy to be here. It's always fun to come here. You're very tolerant people, and thank you for choosing those songs. Just right dead on. I was given three texts by, I guess it was Andre. Is Andre here?
I am. Did show up?
Yeah, I just want to put a face to that name. Good. And the reason I chose to focus on the Revelation text had to do with one of these things that happened in life. I have a brother who is a specialist in the New Testament, so I said, can you give me some really, really, you know, reliable, good books that I can read? I gave him the text, John, and everything. And the John one was this thick, the Revelation one was like that thick, so I thought, I'll go with Revelation. But no, I'm very excited about the Revelation. As I read about that, I saw the Avatar in there. I don't know if any of you have seen Avatar. The basic kind of theme is there. There's a lot of violence in both, but the theme that I'm picking up today from the Book of Revelation is the fundamental nonviolence in it. Fundamental nonviolence in it. That hit me first when I read John Yoder's book, The Politics of Jesus, when he commented on the Book of Revelation, and it's. The title I've chosen here comes from the Revelation passage that one of you read, and it was you, Andre. And that salvation belongs to our God and to the Lamb. And the salvation is actually the word is also means victory as well as salvation. And it belongs to the Lamb, and that salvation is His, not ours. Entirely belongs to God and to the Lamb. We'll sing that passage, and it's the other two passages fit in interestingly. I love the way they chose the lectionary, especially if it's based on the medieval choices. I have never figured out the rationale there, but I figured one out here. The Psalm 100 is actually your choice. One of you told me that you always read it here. Don't you?
I think we've done it recently, actually, just a couple of weeks before.
I see. Yeah. If you always do it, it's fine, too.
That's true.
might memorize it. And it's a psalm of thanksgiving, fundamentally joyful thanksgiving, overflowing with gladness and gratitude. He's simply saying the mere fact that I'm alive is worthy of praise, for myself at least, or nobody else. It's just full of that enthusiasm, which reflects, again, what God has done for him. And the Gospel of John is so interesting because it tells us simply about how people were angry with what Jesus was telling them. And the Gospel, the nonviolent Gospel, does tend to bring out anger in people. And that also happens. I'll make some allusions to that later on. But the Revelation text that we get, and comes through the book repeatedly, is that the victory of the Lamb who represents conclusively that God is love. Because of what God does for us. So it provides mixed messages of crisis with words of assurance and hope to a people who are very afraid of the coming persecution, at least John is. Now, for most people in the Roman Empire, the first two centuries of this era are very good centuries. People are very prosperous. There's finally peace brought to the Mediterranean region. It's not necessarily a happy peace for everybody, but it's peace. And so it means you can make lots of money buying and selling things to foreigners and other things. It's a very good century. But for John, in John's life, there were very damaging things happening to his people. So in the last 35 years of his life, John had seen a number of earthquakes and volcanoes. We have two, right? One in China and one in Iceland right now. unpronounceable, both of them. he had seen a lot of that. He had seen a rebellion against Nero in Rome, and he had seen a civil war in Rome, but he was not living in Rome itself, so it wouldn't have affected him directly. He had seen the destruction of the temple, the Jewish temple, in 70 AD, after the Jews had rebelled against Roman rule. That's what Romans tended to do if you rebelled against them. And it was a time when John was expecting more Christian deaths. There was actually no general persecution of the Jews in the Roman Empire. Rome, in fact, was nor against the Christians, I should say. I meant to say both of them. But let's focus on the Christians. There were probably local incidents where local people got angry at Christians because they didn't participate in the rites of the Roman religion. But the Romans didn't really care a whole lot about what Christians and Jews did. I know we think that they cared about us and they were very angry at us. Jews think the same thing, but in fact they didn't really pay too much attention to them. But as I said, certainly local ones, and John could have been affected by one of those. So just a brief summary of some of the chapters that precede the ones we read. Chapter 1 ends with John saying explicitly, the crisis is near. Something is coming very soon, and that's going to cause a lot of bloodshed. And in chapter 2, John talks about the churches that are not very healthy. They're lukewarm, they've got all kinds of different problems. And as the commentator that I used, Caird, said, it sounds like our own churches today. Weaknesses, and we're not prepared necessarily for the tasks that are ahead of us. But he ends by saying, don't worry, if the churches are going to, they will be clothed with perfection and purity by the bride of Christ. So you may be weak, but the bride of Christ will make you pure and perfect. And in chapters 4 and 5, wonderful, wonderful poetry there. And one of the songs you were choosing, I picked that right up. I don't remember which one it was. It's early on. Fantastic poetry. This is the poetry that John Yoder uses in his book. And it basically comes down to this. There's some seals, not animals, but things that keep papers closed. And these are scrolls that hold the knowledge of the future. What's going to happen? And John finds all these people crying and weeping because nobody can be found to open those seals. Nobody can do it. Nobody's worthy. And finally, they recognize, yes, the Lamb that was slain is worthy. And that theme goes throughout these two chapters. The Lamb that was slain is worthy. Not the Lamb that slew, not the Lamb that slays, but the Lamb that was slain. And that's the fundamental theme of that nonviolent action which is featured in those two chapters. And then we get chapter 6 where where there are the famous four horsemen. The white horse has a rider with a bow with which he will conquer the people. The second, the red horse, is a rider who's come to take away the peace that the Romans had brought. The black horse is a rider with the scales. Not quite sure, but I don't think it's good news. And the pale green horse rider was death. And at the far corners of the earth are strong winds waiting to blow. And all the people see this, all the people, the kings, the rich, the poor, the slaves, they all see this, and even those with the white robes, they run into caves to hide, and because they think, mistakenly, that the danger from the four winds comes from the Lamb that was slain. And so in chapter 7, they see these dangers before them, and they hide. They ask to be hidden from the face of those, and they say, "Hide us from the face of the one seated on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb," thinking that this is where their danger is coming from. And it's not. A lot of people think that that God is the dangerous one. God is coming to punish us, and so did they. And then the angel of the Lord stands up and says to the four winds, "Just hold it a minute here. We're not ready for all this damage you guys are wanting to inflict on us. So it's again, the angel of God intervenes and stops the violence, stops the pain, stops the killing, or before it even happens. So that's the setting of chapter 7 then, which is today's reading. And we started reading in verse 9, I believe it was. The first 8 verses are about, talk about the, as the angel says, stop, we got to put some seals on these people to save them. The first 8 verses talk about the, that 144 people have been selected to be saved. 12 from each tribe. 12,000 from each tribe, sorry. And these, so it's a limited group of people. They're based on the Jewish tribes. And when the Jews did the counting for armies, they counted always heads of households, heads of families. Women and children weren't counted because they weren't going to go to war. But the men would be. So they counted them, and they represented then their family when they were counted. So, but it's limited. Only 144,000 people will be saved here. And then John sees a second vision, and that's where our reading comes in, and he sees an unlimited multitude of people, and they come from all nations. A group so large you couldn't count them. 144,000 is still possible to count, I suppose. And these are all the tribes of the world, not just the 12 tribes. These are all the peoples. They speak all the languages of the world. The whole universe, cosmos, is introduced here. And they're standing before the throne and before the Lamb. They are robed in white with palm branches in their hands, the victory sign. So this new multitude exceeds by far the 144,000 that symbolically represent the tribes of Israel. And so he asks the angel that's beside him, now, who are those? Who are these people robed in white? Who are those who hold the palm branches of the victorious king? And the answer is, these are the ones who have come out of the great ordeal. And what's the great ordeal? They have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. We don't know of anyone, but it could have been one of those incidents I referred to, where some Christian church somewhere in the Roman Empire had been maybe killed, maybe just harassed, maybe the lamb taken from them. It could have been something like that. His audience is supposed to know what this great ordeal is. They are the white-robed martyrs. They have given their lives for Christ. But it's not only them, because that group you could count. But this group is way beyond that. So the great ordeal is not only the physical death, but it is the victory of faith within the lives of people who have chosen to go against Rome. Rome not only in the terms of the city, but the symbol it stands for, the power of the world, the wealth of the world, and people who are caught up against these forces of Rome. So it is those, he said, but it's also the victory of those who have faith over all that seduces and contaminates, and that is represented by Rome then. Today we might say it's the world of power in Ottawa, in Washington, or it might be the power of the financial, industrial, and service corporations of the world who make those kinds of decisions in our lives sometimes. If you're thinking of interest rates, for example, you have no control over that, do you? It's that kind of power that Rome represented. And the people who are the white-robed ones are then, in addition to the martyrs, are those who say in faith, I believe that God was in Christ and that the Lamb is the only one who is worthy for praise and glory and honor, which is one of the Psalms. It's the people who have faith, who accept that proposition or that idea, that belief, basically the fundamental Christian belief. And it is these people who resist Rome and cling to their faith, to their convictions, these who have washed their robes white in the lifeblood of the Lamb. Now there's something interesting here, because they, the people, have washed their own robes white in the blood of the Lamb. We all know that if you did that, your white robe would not come out white. but theirs do. And so what has happened is that the Lamb has done the washing, and what people have done is accepted. These people have done is accepted. Yes, it's not mine. I didn't do this. God did this for me. This is God's work of salvation, as the commentator Caird says, whom I read. They are in no sense praised for human achievements. But their role is one of simply deciding, yes, I'm going to accept it. In other words, God does not coerce anybody into faith. And so that's where their participation is in, saying, choosing, they are free and to choose and to consent, to believe in the free gift of God and in that they act. And as this text also says, salvation belongs to our God who is seated on the throne and to the Lamb. So the salvation is, and the word in the Greek, I don't know any Greek, by the way, I just go with what the Greek people tell me, the people who know Greek tell me. And the word here is soteria, which is, of course, the root word also for salvation. So salvation and victoria in this Revelation context are the same word. It means also preservation. It means also escape. Now, if you're a beleaguered people and you escape the army that's in your face or the people who are threatening to conquer you, then victory and salvation are clearly the same thing. But the victory is that of the Lamb who was slain and who sits alongside God on the throne. Now this God of victory was fully revealed in the cross. And the Lamb has won the battle using only the weapons of redemptive love, nothing else. And for that he is now worthy of honor and praise. Now this believing this gift that we get is incredibly hard. Almost every church, and part of my study in the last 40 to 50 years has been to look at Christianity in its context. I'm not a theologian, not a church historian, but you look at the church, see what's it doing. What's this community actually doing in real life? And almost every church, Anabaptists included, within a generation, slip back into this thinking, well, it's not really just what God has done. If I work hard at being nonviolent, for example, or if I go into Mennonite Central Committee service, this is why I went in. I was hoping that I'd finally overcome all my sins. You know, and I'd be good. That's what MCC people are, aren't they? Well, I found out in the first, second week that I wasn't any different at all. The whole 2 years came out the same way. Well, there were changes. I knew more German. But every church does that. As soon as we say we accept the full salvation that God has offered us, and then as soon as we said that, we start marking on those people that we know who are not, right? And that's what always happens. So it's extremely difficult to really operate entirely on faith. And I like the way Luther puts it in his Easter sermon. I would just take a very small bit of it. He's speaking these sermons in church, and he's speaking them to an audience in Germany. Maybe 15% would have known how to read. Certainly had never taken an intro to theology course. This is all big words to them. So he makes it really plain, and he has Jesus in the tomb and Satan on top of the tomb dancing up and down because he's happy, he's finally conquered this guy, and it's all over now. He makes those vivid images in there. And then he says, what happens when, as soon as Christ dies, all that dancing from Satan stops. I'm sorry, is raised from the dead, then the dancing stops. And then he says, because today Christ comes forth from the grave, one sees in him neither death nor sin nor sadness, but sheer life and joy. Everything that the devil, sin, and death have done is destroyed. And he says, it is easy to say such words, but still no one believes it. And yet it is true. A believer has no sin and is Lord over sin. And my God conclusion that is always, despite all evidence to the contrary, I am righteous. So are you, by the way. because you may not have any evidence to the contrary. Those are the people that the writer John in Revelation is saying they are also wearing the white robes. Now, another point I want to make is that God leaves no one out in this description in Revelation. In Revelation 7, the chapter that was read, verse 9, all tribes and all peoples and all languages are present, and they will have no hunger. Oh, sorry, they will hunger no more and thirst no more. Never thirsty again. The sun will not strike them, no sunburn, nor any scorching heat. For the Lamb at the center of the throne will be their shepherd, and he will guide them to springs of water of life, and God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. Later in Revelation chapter 21, he comes back to this theme, talking about the new heaven and the new earth, when God himself will live among human beings, among mortals. The nations will walk by its light, by that light of that city, and the kings of the earth will bring their splendor into it. And on no day will its gates ever be shut. It's a total open city. And what's interesting is that we will be able to bring our culture in. That's what the kings of the earth are doing. You will be able to bring, as professor of theology Karl Barth once found, when he wanted to know, he wanted to make sure that Mozart was going to be in heaven. Because if he wasn't, he didn't want to be there either. So that Mozart can be there, Bach, and techno, other things like that. Apparently, we can bring those things with us, but there are certain things we can't, and I'll get to those in a moment. As for the cowardly, the faithless, the polluted, the murderers, the fornicators, the sorcerers, the idolaters, and all liars, their place will be in the lake that burns with fire and sulfur, which is the second death. Their place will be in the fiery lake of burning sulfur. That looks like eternal punishment, doesn't it? But maybe it's not. As I read before, the white robe will never thirst again. And those other ones, then, they're not white robed. And if they are thirsty, they are free to come into these doors because they're always open. And those who are thirsty can come in. So we've taken care of the white robe people because they'll never be thirsty. So if we don't have the white robe, you can always come in. Doors will never close. So that's why I'm raising the question of whether that really is eternal punishment. Because he says some other things too. To me, that is the unlimited, limitless mercy of God. I was trying to think of this, the theology that I grew up in, but not very much pressure from my father about these things. But still, the theology I picked up was, those who don't, are not converted, they're going to everlasting heaven. Hell, sorry. Sorry, it was Freudian slip, I suppose. That there are those who do the right things, say the right words, they're going to heaven forever, and then there are the bad people who go to hell forever. And but it doesn't make sense, because why would God in Christ, now I'm using human logic now, so you can totally discard it, but still it's my thought and I want to share that. Why would Christ go to all that trouble to be kind and loving, to die on the cross, to have God raise him from the dead, that then starts counting, looks at his watch, okay, in 24 hours times 19,000 years, then I'm going to get merciless. Then I'm going to start killing these people that I died for. I find trouble in that logic, but I could be totally wrong. You don't like that, you're entitled to it. Okay, I want to conclude by talking a little bit about martyrdom and reward, because they are central to John's discourse. And what is the meaning? What meaning can martyrdom have today? As Mennonites, some of us grew up with Martyr's Mirror being the central book in our family's library. It's a book written in 1660 about martyrs in the Netherlands and Germany and a few other lands nearby. The idea in these martyrs, in the martyrs' mirrors, was that these are saintly people. And I think they probably have a right to call themselves saintly. They died for their faith. But there, of course, there were other Mennonites who didn't die. And if you go through the martyrs' mirror, there's all these wonderful stories about people who escaped from being killed as martyrs. They didn't want to die. They're kind of like you and me. So they snuck away. And there's one woman, Sabina Bader of Augsburg. She was foremost a mother, willing to do whatever necessary, including stealing, to save her skin and herself and unite herself with her children. That's what her job, that's what her primary goal is. And she's in their ranks there too, a good Anabaptist woman. So martyrs, the martyrdom is a complex term. One of the areas that I think is eligible for martyr is the Christian Peacemakers team. I was very, very perplexed when I found out that. And when you go to CPT training sessions, they have about a half a day where they prepare you to die. No, we're not used to that, are we? Preparing to die just to go on a voluntary service project. I don't know if it was half a day or not, but it was some time. That kind of sobered me up a little bit. And we know that Tom Fox, in 2006, an American who went to Iraq as a witness for peace and a member of CPT, was kidnapped and murdered there. And that makes us think about martyrdom. Now, the Christian Peacemaker team is reluctant to use that term, martyr, because they say that will tend to get people angry and want to have more violence on behalf of them, on our side then, maybe. Or that it will encourage their impulse for revenge and violence. There's another martyr that recently came into the news, a missionary sister, Dorothy Stang. She worked for about 30 years in the Amazon forest of Brazil, trying to help peasants farm. It's a little odd to think, you know, here's a Catholic nun, sister, helping people to farm. But she did that for 30 years. She made a lot of enemies. And she knew that she was going to be killed. Two men came to her and so she, with guns, and she said, "I'd like to read some biblical passages to you." And they said, "Fine, we'll listen for a while." And then they said, "This is enough," and they shot her. And so it's a classic martyr's death, you know, reading the scriptures while being killed. So there are still martyrs that we know about that get the press. There's probably many, many more who don't get into the newspapers. But for me, a very intriguing martyr is and what was Rachel Corrie from Olympia. I read about her when I was still teaching, and I'd always end my History of Civilization course, which went into today's time, with having students hear about her. It's a Christian university, I'm not a Prendios university, I don't know if I said that. But to have them see that I'm bringing a non-Christian in as a martyr was supposed to be thought-provoking. So she, what's fantastic about her is she does not identify herself as a Christian, but her death is like that of a martyr. Her emails were preserved by her parents, and in these emails, her cry just comes piercing out at us. She's very human. She wants to simply do the things that 20-year-olds do, to go shopping, to listen to music, to dance, and to pursue a career. It rings so authentic. That's what I wanted to do, she said. It so is also her declaration that she simply cannot live normally, and nor should anyone else be able to, she says, in the light of the destruction of the homes of the Palestinians for whom she was working. So just a brief section from one of her letters. This has to stop. I think it is a good idea for us all to drop everything and devote our lives to making this stop. I don't think it's an extremist thing to do anymore. I still really want to dance around to Pat Benatar, I have no idea who she is, and have boyfriends, or maybe it's a he, and make comics for my co-workers, But I also want this to stop. Disbelief and horror is what I feel. Disappointment. I am disappointed that this is the base reality of our world and that we, in fact, participate in it. This is not at all what I asked for when I came into this world. This is not at all what the people here asked for when they came into this world. So, what about the white-robed people and today's crises? There is no escape from real death for any of us. Probably most of us will also endure some suffering or have already. We live in a very affluent society that still has incredibly way too many people that are poor and homeless, both adults and children. We live in a society where the lack of care for the disabled one, or less able ones, let's call them that, and the old and the young, I may be self-interested in that, but we still kind of think of them as a warehouse. Okay, you don't fit in here anymore because you got this ailment, so we'll take you from your wife and put you there, and she'll stay there. I mean, that's the kind of thing you read about, and it's horrible. That's the kind of world that the white-robed people try to change. There's also the erosion of human rights and open government. And then, last week was a little earlier, the sight of thousands of people gathered across the river from the seat of U.S. government, down in Virginia, government is in Washington, D.C., holding guns, angry because the government has offered health care to some of their co-citizens. What does this say about our times when people want to gather in front of the White House with guns, three or four stashed onto their body? This is what the television showed. The call then to faithfulness is for us as urgent as it was in John's day. We too, as first century churches, are people of weakness and fears and anxieties. We too are called to worship the Lamb that was slain. We have difficulty following Jesus' new commandment, that is, that ye love one another as I've loved you. We have difficulty accepting notions that God loves both the good and the bad, and that our goodness does not make us central to God's act of salvation. But we can leave here this morning or this noon with the assurance, afternoon I guess, with the assurance that just as God washed the robes of the first century Christians, so will God wash our robes. We too are in the new city of God, the new Jerusalem, where the invitation is, let anyone come who wishes to take the water of life as a gift. Chapter 22, verse 17. Let's meditate on the words that come from a book called Take Our Moments and Our Days, published by a group of people in Elkhart. God of abiding presence, you lead us by your Spirit and claim us as your children. Call us in righteousness and renew us in hope and joy, that we may be messengers of your peace, fearlessly announcing your salvation through Jesus, who taught us how to pray for the coming of your reign. Amen.